Blog Talk Radio.
The Late Shift with Stephen Bell is presented live and uncensored and contains adult language. The views, opinions, and verbiage expressed do not reflect those of LordsOfPain.net, Lords of Pain Radio, Blog Talk Radio, or any of their respective advertisers. That's all on me, for better or for worse. Regardless, listener discretion is advised. Now let's do this thing. Let's give it a bee-bop-bow. And now, coming to you live from the Late Shift Studios, recapping SmackDown Live here on Lords of Pain Radio, it's the Late Shift with Stephen Bell, with your host, well, me. Again, and yeah, still me. Let's do this thing, all right? Grab some fun. Do the crunch guitar. Come on, I love that. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome once again to The Late Shift with Stephen Bell. I am your host, Stephen Bell, hence why my name is in the title. And we are here to talk about SmackDown Live this evening. It was set to be a pretty big show. Last night, I was talking about how we could wind up with a show that was halfway women. You know, just if you really averaged it out and factored in how many promo packages there were and you know, just whatever the hell. And the two matches, of course, a whole, like, hour's worth of women's stuff this evening, which would have added up to, like, half the show, which would have been super awesome. It would have just been further proof of WWE saying mea culpa, mea culpa, you know, coupled with what they did last night, where they had an over 30-minute match to end the show with the women, only 1 week after having only featured them for maybe 3 or 4 minutes collectively. And then this week, you know, of course, there was the fallout from Money in the Bank last week, and then they turn around and they give us, well, a Money in the Bank match and a women's championship match. The only problem with all of that is that, well, the women's championship match didn't exactly deliver in any way, shape, form, or fashion. And it's not the in the ring sucked or anything like that, because I know what some of you were thinking coming into it. Is Lana going to be able to have another decent match as she did at Money in the Bank? It wasn't a great match. Wasn't a good match, but it was a decent match. Is she going to be able to pull it off again? Well, we didn't get to find out, because it was essentially a squash match, which is strange. I don't get that one. I don't completely understand that. I am curious to see where that goes, but at the moment, I'm just kind of like, what the hell? You know what I mean? So I guess we'll see as it pertains to that as we move forward, and we'll talk about that match and the potential ramifications from it and my thoughts on it, all that good stuff here in just a little bit as we dig a little bit deeper into this evening's episode of SmackDown Live. But, well, we're not exactly going to be talking about SmackDown in the Heat Seeker this evening. We have an anniversary here among us today. It is an interesting one, the way that time's out and all that. And, well, why keep the cat in the bag? Let's go ahead and kick this bad boy off. It is time once again for your favorite and mine. It's the the heater. It didn't play for some reason. It said it was playing. Let's try it again. Okay, sure, whatever. It's the Heat Seeker. I'll try to do it for you. Heat Seeker, Heat Seeker. Okay, is that better? I think that's better. It is indeed time for the Heat Seeker, and, well, this time around we are looking at something a little bit special. It was 15 years ago today that John Cena made his way into the WWE, made his debut on the WWE main roster, at least on television. He, of course, had done some dart matches and crap like that, but that don't count. John Cena walked out 15 years ago this evening. Kurt Angle was out there. He was kind of issuing an open challenge saying, hey, if anybody back there has got the guts to come out here and face an Olympic champion, the best wrestler in the world, well, then you guys just bring it right on out here, and I'm happy to face you. And John Cena comes out there. Nobody knew who the hell he was. He was just a new dude, and it was all like, okay, who's this guy? He's just, you know, wearing, like, the colors of the hometown, just a jacked-up dude with a buzz cut. Didn't know who the hell he was. He comes walking out there. He introduces himself to Kurt Angle, or at least kind of does. He walks in there. Kurt Angle's like, who the hell are you? He said, I'm John Cena. And he smacked him across the face, and then we had ourselves a little match. And John Cena acquitted himself very well. He, you know, he almost had him a couple of times. Kurt Angle winds up winning, though. But then what really made John Cena afterwards was that he was backstage. They showed him after the match. And everybody's all like, good job, good all the other people on the show, you know, the Rey Mysterio and whatnot. They're all like, good job, dude. And he's all like, thanks. And then The Undertaker walks up, who was – The Undertaker was in the midst of kind of pseudo-turning babyface-ish, but he was a heel at the time. It was American Badass Undertaker. He was not a dude to fucking trifle with. He was the Undisputed Champion at the time as well. He walks up to John Cena, asks his name, and he told him he did a good job, and he shook his hand. So – got a little bit of a rub from the dead man there, which never, never, never sucks. So that was – it was very interesting. Very interesting first night for John Cena. And it played out pretty interestingly from there. If you would like to hear a little more of an intrinsic breakdown of it, I encourage you to listen to the latest episode of Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard. They talked about that subject this last Friday on the new episode of that podcast. And it was pretty good. It was pretty good stuff. If you want to hear about the early years of John Cena, it's like from his debut through to WrestleMania 20. So, yeah, good stuff. Good stuff. And I lived through all this. I remember very vividly seeing it. It doesn't seem like it's been 15 years, but it has been. And that in and of itself is something impressive. And this is one of those heat seekers where, you know, it's not going to be terribly controversial, but it might be because I'm going to say a couple of things over the course of this that could be considered somewhat controversial. 15 years is a long time, guys, especially in the professional wrestling business, okay? Factor that in. Try to put this in context, if you will. Hulk Hogan became WWE champion, and Hulkamania began in 1984. Was when it really kicked off, early in 1984 at that. So it was almost the entirety of 1984. Either way, 1984. 15 years from 1984 is 1999. Hulkamania nowhere to be seen. None of the things that were going on in wrestling at that time were going on at a later date. Things had changed so remarkably drastically. We had gone through two whole eras by that point. It was the landscape was completely different. And that has kind of been the case over the years. Now, maybe it says something for how WWE's product has gotten somewhat stagnant to a degree over the course of the last 15 years, that it really doesn't seem like much has changed. A lot more has changed than you really recognize it just at face value, but what can't be taken away from anything, whether it's staleness of the product, you want to point the finger at that, or whether you do acknowledge that it has changed a whole super-duper bunch in the last 15 years since 2002 when John Cena walked in the door. The bottom line is that John Cena has been pretty remarkable over the course. He didn't jump to the top immediately, of course. He worked as kind of pretty much a mid-card guy trying to work his way up the ladder. And then by the time WrestleMania 20 rolled around, he was officially like on the top of the mid-card. You know, he was the U.S. champion after defeating the Big Show at WrestleMania 20. It wasn't until WrestleMania 21 that he really ascended. That was 2005. So we're looking at, you know, he had about 3 years where he, you know, almost 3 years, where he was just kind of chilling out and doing stuff and maxing and relaxing all cool and all, shooting some b-ball outside of the school and whatnot. And then he began his run. And from the moment that he really won that first championship at WrestleMania 21, it's pretty much been the John Cena show. There have been other people who have come up. There's been, you know, Randy Orton has come up, you know, and the other two, meaning him and Batista, who also was crowned as the big champion at WrestleMania 21. Huge watershed moment, really, for that era. That was supposed to be the crowning of the two top guys right there. Batista didn't so much last for a super-duper long time, but, man, John Cena sure has. He's been around for a very, very long time now, and it has officially become time where if you're looking at things objectively, if you're removing your personal opinions of John Cena's character, his work rate, whatever the crap you want to throw out there, you know, that doesn't really concern us, you know, work rate. Why should we be concerned about work rate? You know what I mean? He doesn't face strong enough opposition. And blah, blah, blah. Is he entertaining? Yeah. Well, okay then. That's all that really needs to matter there. Either he is to you or he's not to you. Roll with that. And okay, maybe work rate fucking factors into it. And I'm not going to get off on that little tangent, but I digress. Bottom line is that if you look at things objectively, if you step back and remove emotion from the entire thing, John Cena very well may be the greatest WWE champion of all time. I don't say that lightly either, because, I mean, if you look at, you know, if you were to ask somebody, Mount Rushmore, you know, of WWE specifically, you would have, of course, Hulk Hogan would be up there. Stone Cold Steve Austin would be up there. You could make a strong argument for The Rock. You know, you could make just as, in my opinion, you could make just as strong an argument for The Rock as you could for Stone Cold, almost. Like, Stone Cold's got him by a little bit, because Stone Cold was really the one who, if it weren't for Stone Cold Steve Austin being what he was, then The Rock never would have got a shake. Nobody would have known who the hell The Rock was, because they wouldn't have been watching in the first place. So Austin does have an edge, but if you look at things in terms of how long they were on top and stuff like that, well, you know, it's kind of even. But anyways, and then who else you got to throw up there? Well, you know, it'd be nice if you could say Randy Orton or CM Punk or something like that. You know, you could even throw out like a Shawn Michaels or a Bret Hart or Triple H even. Or there's plenty of names that you could throw out there, Macho Man Randy Savage even. But at the end of the day, it's got to be John Cena. It kind of has to be. It's been 15 years, and a solid 12 or so of those have been on top. This dude has just been running game in WWE for a super long time, an unprecedented amount of time. I mentioned Hulk Hogan before, and, I mean, looking back on it, it seems like Hulk Hogan was on top of WWE forever and ever and ever and a day. But Hulkamania was comparatively short, if compared to the run of John Cena. He, like I said before, Hulk Hogan won the title in 1984. He won it and lost it for the last time in 1993. That is a 9-year run. He had been out for, you know, the majority of at least a couple of years over the course of that. You know, between WrestleManias 8 and 9, he was gone pretty much. And between WrestleManias 7 and 8, he was gone for a good little bit there. He was starting to do movies and things of that nature around that time. Either way, yeah, let's just say, let's call a spade on that one. Yeah, from 1984 to 1993, it could be argued that Hulk Hogan was it in WWE. Even though by the time that he had won the championship again in 1993 when he won it at WrestleMania 9, the torch had kind of already been passed. Bret Hart was already the guy by that point, and it was just kind of to hear certain people tell it, again, I mentioned Bruce Prichard, to hear him tell it, it was supposed to be kind of the Hulk Hogan farewell tour. They knew they were going to be going on an overseas tour shortly after WrestleMania. They wanted to be able to say, okay, Hulk Hogan's coming to Europe or whatever the hell, so that people would turn out and kind of Hulk Hogan, because it was, the writing was on the wall as pertained to that. It was looking like the Hulkster was pretty much done, you know? And so, there it was. That was it. The end. You know, there's no more Hulk Hogan in WWE for a very long time. That was 9 years. 9 years. Which is a fairly long time, but really, 9 years. And then I've mentioned before, with Stone Cold Steve Austin, you can count 1997 when he was really running hot. Let's go ahead and do that. Let's be generous. Let's say 1997, okay? 1997, WrestleMania 13. Let's say that's when Austin really kind of started catching fire. So you've got, you know, the rest of 97, all of 98, most of 99, and then he's gone for a year. Picked back up in 2000, he comes on back, he's really getting rolling hot as we head towards WrestleMania 17, and in 2001, he hangs around for that, and then he rolls into 2002, shortly after that WrestleMania, he leaves. He's gone for like 6 or 8 months, he comes back in 2003, he has like 2-3 matches, and then he retires. So really, let's look at this. So 1997, 98, 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, that's 7 years. That's 7 years if you're being generous, and then knock out like 2 of those for various injuries and ball-taking homes and whatnot. Steve Austin really only had like 4, maybe 5 years on top of the business. That's nothing, really. I mean, he made a hell of money, and he's highly influential, but you also have to factor in there that, you know, for the last half of that run, The Rock was carrying at least half of that load. You know what I mean? Was as big, if not a bigger star than Steve Austin, because he was the one who kind of took over the pull in the wagon when Austin was out for the entirety of 2000. So, I mean, yeah, there's that. Hogan, to his credit, really didn't have anybody else. He had Macho and stuff, but Macho was, you know, a heel for a good portion of that. He was a bad guy, the Warrior, but the Warrior was kind of a failed experiment. Hogan was really kind of, he was the guy for the duration of his run. Austin was the guy to a lot of people for the duration of his run, but he was definitively the guy for at least half of it. Still, Austin's run was maybe half of what Hogan's was, and now you look at the next guy to come along. Guy, you know, you had your John Cena's and stuff, and pardon me, your Triple H's and whatnot in the meantime, But then John Cena shows up, and when he is crowned, he don't let go of said crown. And now it has been 15 years that he's been around. Let's just go ahead and say 13 years on top. 13 years on top. That is almost the runs of, if you were to take the runs of Hulk Hogan and Stone Cold Steve Austin and combine them, you would just about have the amount of time that John Cena has been on top of WWE. And that is, when you think about it in those terms, when you really break it down into those kind of numbers, it's kind of shocking. You know, you don't think about things like that. If you're like me, if you're my age, and I know a lot of folks out there are around a similar age, or at the very least of an age where you may be, you know, you've been familiar with John Cena throughout the duration of his career. It doesn't seem like it was that long ago. You know what I mean? It does on one hand, but at the same time, it really, it in some ways it feels like John Cena's been around for fucking ever, okay? But in other ways, it feels like he kind of just got here. It certainly doesn't seem as though it's been 15 years, and it certainly doesn't seem as, he's not showing it. You know, John Cena is still just as John Cena as he ever was. It's arguable that just a couple years ago when he had that U.S. title run and all the things that were going on there, that was arguably the best fucking in-ring year of his entire career. John Cena might be at his best right now, this deep into his run. That is crazy, man. Nobody else can say that. Austin couldn't say that because, unfortunately, of injury. Rock couldn't say that because he was busy doing other shit. Hogan couldn't say that because Hogan was never exactly king shit inside the ring in the first place. But also, I mean, to be fair to Hulk Hogan, he did then have another dominant run in WCW. If you were to combine all of Hulk Hogan's great years, let's do that right quick then, okay? 1984 to 1993, 9 years. Let's just call it 9 years. You know, it's not, because, you know, give or take a month or two here or there. But still, let's just call it 9 years. Then he's gone for a year. He shows back up mid-1994, and Hulk Hogan was basically running shit in WCW until, let's say, 2000 at Bash on the Beach. Even though he was gone a lot and he wasn't running shit for the, you know, the last year or so of that, let's just go ahead and say 2000. So 1984 to 2000 minus a year in between there, what would that be? 16 years minus one is 15. So Hulk Hogan had 15 strong years of being on top of the professional wrestling business between two companies, a heel run, and just very sporadic schedule for the latter half. Well, yeah, the latter half. You could just go ahead and say the latter half of that run. Meanwhile, John Cena is just now starting to enter his sporadic period. And, you know, yeah, it's comparable to Hogan. It's comparable to Hogan. And I think that if you ask anybody in the business who is the greatest box office attraction in the history of of professional wrestling, they would probably say Hulk Hogan. Vince McMahon will try to tell you Steve Austin because he sold a fuck ton of pay-per-views and T-shirts and all that stuff. But again, that needs to be put into its place. That was only for a very short amount of time. Steve Austin was only that big of a draw, that big of a bad motherfucker, for approximately 4 to 5 years. And I love Stone Cold, but again, we're dealing facts here, okay? And that's just the simple fact of the matter. Hulk Hogan has to be considered the biggest draw of all time. I don't remember Stone Cold Steve Austin cartoons or serials and whatnot, so that is what that is. John Cena's got to be infringing upon that. And the fact that it's been all with one company, it's been consistent as shit, and he's gotten better as he's gone along, which is weird. That never happens. That's just bizarre. The only guy who I can think of who had a great run and then had a better run towards the end of his whole thing is Shawn Michaels. You know, like, Shawn Michaels got better, it seemed like, kind of as he went along. But Cena, he just, again, it's arguable that he could be at the peak of his powers right now. He's still knocking out match of the year contenders pretty much every time he gets in the ring, you know, with the last time he got into the ring being kind of an exception to the rule there. That was just meant to be sign of a feature thing at WrestleMania against The Miz and the Marines with Nikki and all that stuff, you know what I mean? But, I mean, think about the matches he's had with, like, AJ Styles at the Rumble, and John Cena's kind of running game. So I guess what I'm getting at here is I'm just trying to make a case, because I know that as soon as I said that John Cena might be the greatest WWE superstar of all time, and I know that when they said arguably the greatest WWE superstar of all time on television tonight, I'm sure a lot of you out there rolled your eyes so hard that you could see your brain. But I'm here to tell you that if you just look at numbers, that just might be true. And if you're looking at numbers in terms of money made, even, I mean, look at the runs. John Cena, in his 9 most profitable years, if you were to cherry pick them throughout the course of this run, there's no way in hell John Cena has made as much money in his 9 most profitable years as Hulk Hogan made in his 9 most profitable years, okay? Let's call a spade a spade. And there's no way that in his 5 most profitable years that he made as much money as Austin made in his 5 most profitable years, okay? Okay, let's go ahead and get that out of the way. But cumulative. You can't tell me that John Cena, over the course of 15 years, hasn't made more money for the company than Steve Austin did in 5 or 6. You can't tell me that he didn't make more, hasn't made more money for the company in 15 years than Hulk Hogan did in 9. So John Cena is probably the most profitable WWE superstar of all time. And even if you take it to kayfabe numbers, he's a 16-time world champion. Nobody else comes close to that with the exception of Randy Orton. And I guess Triple H ain't too far behind it, but still, I mean, that's pretty fucking impressive. So next week we're going to see John Cena come back. It's going to be interesting. He's going to be traipsing out there on the 4th of July. We're not entirely sure what he's going to be doing. They're really pushing this whole free agent button awfully damn hard, and who the hell knows what it means. Does that mean that both shows are going to be courting him and trying to woo him? Does that mean that he is free-floating and can work with anybody on either show as he damn well pleases? Who knows exactly what that means? I guess we'll start to get some kind of a definition. Well, we probably won't get a clear definition of what it is this time, but, you know, he'll be around, and then he'll probably leave to go do something else. Next time he comes around, then we'll probably have a more clear definition of what free agency means as it pertains to John Cena. But either way, the dude's coming back next week. It's kind of curious to me that they picked next week because, yeah, 4th of July, that's cool. You want to pop a big number on the 4th of July, or at least try to. Also, you know, he's John Cena. He's very strongly associated with the military and things of that nature, even though he never served and stuff, which isn't a knock on him. I'm just saying, you know, it's just the truth. He never served. But he is very strongly tied to the military, and he supports the military in many big, big ways and all that good stuff. So bringing him in on the 4th of July, okay, maybe that makes a hell of a lot of sense. But why wouldn't you bring him back a week earlier on the exact 15-year – what are the odds that would work out that way? The exact 15-year anniversary of him coming out on SmackDown and answering an open challenge. How easy would it have been to have Kevin Owens come out tonight, issue an open challenge, and John Cena is the one who responds to it? Like, that would have been picture perfect. But no, they were never going to do it that way. 4th of July is kind of the way to go. It's just, it's interesting that it timed out the way that it did. And bottom line is that John Cena's been around for 15 years. That's pretty damn cool. You know, that's a long run. He's not done yet. I think John Cena could be around for 20 plus years. Frankly, John Cena could have an Undertaker-esque run, though he is obviously kind of scaling things back a little bit at the moment. Kind of depends on how high his stock and his star rises in Hollywood. It could go pretty far. I'm thinking, you know, his movie roles seem to be getting more substantial. His projects seem to be getting a lot more mainstream, you know, being on the Today Show and interviewing Bill Gates and hosting television shows and things of that nature. It seems like the guy's really making inroads. He just hosted SNL this last year. People know who John Cena is now. He's the first real crossover star in professional wrestling since The Rock. You know, even Austin didn't cross over to the level that John Cena has, I think it is arguable to say. People might have known Stone Cold from wrestling, you know, but if you asked most people today, if you showed them a picture of Stone Cold Steve Austin, they might not be able to tell you who the hell that is. Most people know who John Cena is, though, nowadays. He's a pop culture figure. And that's pretty cool. He's come a long way over the course of these 15 years. He's done a lot for the professional wrestling business at a time that it needed it desperately. You know, this has not been a good 15 years for us. A lot of rocky, bad things have happened over the course of this time. The business is kind of tanked as it pertains to just overall interest. You know, we're not riding the heyday or anything. There's no hot streak or anything going on right now. We've had people drop dead, unfortunately. We've had unfortunate incidents like the Benoit thing. There's been some bad things going on, and all the familiar stars are just about gone now. You know, they're all retired and this and that, and John Cena has been the constant, and he has been needed as that constant very, very much, and that's laudable. We all kind of, as wrestling fans, we all owe a bit of a debt to John Cena for being the guy out there waving the flag when there wasn't really anybody else who could do it. So I'm going to be welcoming John Cena back next week. I'm looking forward to seeing him. I used to not be a very big Cena fan. I wasn't a big Cena fan for a long, long time. I liked him when he was the rapper guy, you know, and the heel rapper dude in his early days, and I kind of was all right with him. But I, much like a lot of other people, turned against him when it came time for him to wrestle Chris Jericho at, I believe it was SummerSlam 2005. He wrestled Chris Jericho there for the championship. He beat Chris Jericho, and I was done with him. I was a little bit fed up with old John Cena from that point forward. And things like One Night Stand and all that, and that just kind of, you know, against Rob Van Dam, and I was one of those old-school ECW guys who was just like, fuck you, Cena! I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen when he took his shirt off and threw it into the crowd, and they fucking threw it back at him. I still think that's one of the greatest things I've ever seen, frankly. And also, for the record, just while we're talking about John Cena stuff, that was the first ever If Cena Wins, We Riot sign. And that is the only time in the history of If So-and-So Wins, We Riot signs that I think that it might have been true. If John Cena had beaten Rob Van Dam in that building that evening, there very well may have been a riot. That crowd was rowdy. That crowd was hot. That crowd was not a crowd that I personally would have wanted to fuck with if I were in the midst of all of them like that. Yeah, it's been a fun ride watching John Cena do what he does, and he's a different guy now than he was when he showed up, but at the same time, he's been about the most consistent dude that you could possibly hope for. He's coming back next week. We'll be talking about him here on The Late Shift, but tonight I wanted to dedicate this Heat Seeker here to him because it has been 15 years. It certainly doesn't feel like it's been 15 years. My God, I don't know where the hell it has gone. For all you younger folks out there, I know that you probably balk when you hear older people say something along the lines of, man, time's going by so fast. Or if you're in high school or something, I remember high school felt like fucking forever to me. It felt like it just went on and on and on. It felt like I was in high school for 10 fucking years, just four. And I'll tell you what, man, 4 years gets away from you before you know what the fuck happened. Nowadays, you know, 4 years ago, I was, you know, pretty freshly married and stuff like that. And now, fast forward and look where I am now. You know, I'm damn near divorced. You know, man, time flies really, really fast. So this 15 years has just blown by, and it's been really fun watching him evolve. It's been fun watching WWE evolve around him for both better and for worse. I'm interested in seeing where he goes from this point into the future. More than anything else, I'm interested in seeing what he does next week, because at the end of the day, that's what we're here for, man. It's professional wrestling. 1 week after the next, 1 foot after, you know, we ain't to be worried about what's going to happen 5 years from now. It's all about next week. What have you done for me lately, John Cena? Last time we saw you, it was a happy, fun little, you know, Today Show moment, kissing your little girlfriend and all that shit. Well, it's time to get that back down to business. It's time to see what's going on here. I hope that we get, you know, it's not going to happen, but I would love it if John Cena walked in next week and was like, so, you know, I've been hearing a lot about this Shinsuke Nakamura. That would be, if we just walk into SummerSlam having Shinsuke Nakamura versus John Cena, I'd be all over that, like stink on shit, man. That'd be awesome. Probably not going to happen, but who knows what the future holds. I'm looking forward to it, and here's to John Cena in 15 years of the C-Nation. The chain gang, if you will. Word life. This is indeed basic thugonomics. He is untouchable, but he's been forcing you to feel him. I'll be back here in just a second to talk about SmackDown Live this evening. We had an interesting show. It didn't quite go the way that I had hoped that it would in some regards, and in other ways, it was pretty damn fun. So, yeah, we got a lot to talk about. We'll get to that here in just a second. But first, we do have a few bills to pay here on LOP Radio to keep this bad boy free for you. So I invite you to check out this right here. All right, back in the mix here on The Late Shift, and we are talking about SmackDown Live. I want to give you a little reminder here. If you want to get in touch with me, if you want to say this, you want to say that, you want to tell me I'm wrong, you want to tell me I'm right, and anything that you want to say to me, you can find me on social media. It's not that hard to do, my friends. You can find me on Facebook. Just look for The Late Shift with Stephen Bell, and there I am, rock you like a hurricane. You can find the page, and you can also find me on Twitter, at Stephen F. and Bell. And yeah, I'm happy to chat with you guys any which way that you want to get at me. It's always good times. Let's go ahead and jump into this thing, though. We were coming from San Diego, California, the 619, if you will, and we opened the show with the Money in the Bank briefcase hanging over the ring. We get Daniel Bryan opening the show. He makes his way out there. The fans are saying yes, yes, yes. Daniel Bryan's very happy to be there. They're very happy to see him. He says that he's proud of the women's division, and then he plugs tonight's two big matches, just like I was doing last night. I thought that this was going to be big time. Hell, I was doing it last week, too. It looked like this was going to be a big night for the women. Daniel Bryan seemed to agree it was going to be Lana taking on the SmackDown Women's Champion Naomi, and, of course, the rematch, the Money in the Bank ladder match, with Carmella and Natalya and Tamina and Becky Lynch and Charlotte. And he was hyped about it. He was starting to talk about it a little bit, but then the music interrupts. Out comes Carmella along with James Ellsworth. FABERLOUS. She is fabulous. They make their way out there. Carmella says, you keep on talking about this is the land of opportunity. No, this is the land of injustice, not the land of opportunity. You unjustly shot my briefcase. And she said all the same things that she pretty much said last week. You know, there were no rules in the match. It shouldn't have been taken away from me. Did anybody take Sheamus's away or whatever? Any time that people have interfered in the past, did they get their Money in the Bank briefcase taken away? No. But Carmella did, and it's unfair. So, she has been done wrong. And Daniel Bryan's like, you know what? You have a point. So I'm going to ask the fans, hey, fans, should I just cancel the match tonight and give Carmella the briefcase? And everybody's like, boo. And he said, okay, should we go ahead and have the second ever in history Women's Money in the Bank ladder match tonight? And everybody's like, yes, yes, yes. And like, well, Ellsworth then grabs the microphone. He tells everyone they need to shut up with the chants because they make him sick. He says that the fans are the villains here because they control this stupid little puppet, Daniel Bryan. He says that Bryan takes pleasure in humiliating his home girl, Carmella. People are chanting, Ellsworth sucks, and all this. You know, his not a very warm reception for our pal, the Big Hog, this evening. He says that Daniel Bryan is just as pathetic as the fans. He used to look up to Daniel Bryan as a man, but now when he looks at him, he doesn't even see a man. He only sees a gutless, spineless coward that has no grapefruits to cut it in the ring anymore, so he made up some kind of an injury. Bryan looks like he's getting pissed, but then he laughs it off. He says, I probably should just fire you, but tonight, it's not about you. It's about the real superstars of SmackDown. He knows that he said last week that Ellsworth would be banned from ringside. He actually said that on Talking Smack. But you know what? He's taking it back. He's not going to be banned from ringside. He's going to be banned from the arena. He wants Ellsworth out of the building, calls for security. They come out there, and Carmella is trying to be like, no, he didn't mean it. And she's begging Daniel Bryan to change his mind. Security comes out. Ellsworth tries to run away. They wind up grabbing him and dragging him out of there. He breaks away. They grab him again. And, they wind up carrying him away to the back, and it was pretty funny. So that was the opening segment there, and it was fairly entertaining was a retread from what we saw last week. If they were looking to reset a little bit, kind of catch everybody up or whatever as to what was going on in the story, well, they did a pretty good job of it there in just the beginning. We heard Carmella's argument. We saw Daniel Bryan's response. Now we have James Ellsworth out of the equation, so we can just move ahead as we see fit. But it did retread a whole lot of ground that we tread over last week, so that was kind of interesting. Anyways, once that is all said and done, we are informed that still to come this evening, it will be Lana taking on Naomi for the SmackDown Women's Championship, and also we will be seeing Baron Corbin take on Sami Zayn yet again. Those guys have had multiple matches, with Sami Zayn stealing victories over Baron Corbin multiple times. Would he have the same luck this evening? Well, we'll find out here before too long. But before we get to that, we saw the Hype Bros backstage. They are coming towards the ring as we go to commercial. And when we come back, out come the Hype Bros. Now, this was a little deal that they made last week because, if you recall, the night that Zack Ryder got injured, he did so while winning a Battle Royal that made the Hype Bros the number one contenders for the tag team titles. So hurts. They couldn't take advantage of their number one contendership. So the question when they came back was, well, what's the dealio? Do we still get a tag team title shot? You know, because I did earn the number one contendership, or has it been too long? What's the deal? So they made a deal with them. Daniel Bryan made a deal with them. It's like, okay, well, if you can go out there, if you can beat the Usos in a non-title match, pickety bam, it's that easy. So that's what they're trying to do this evening. That is the plot line of this match. It is the Hype Bros versus the Usos non-title match, and if the Hype Bros win, they are the number one contenders. Zack Ryder starts off alongside Jimmy Uso, and they are, you know, fighting back and forth. Ryder hits a big flapjack, gets a two count out of that. Mojo then comes in. They're double-teaming on the Usos. Jay winds up getting the tag, chops Mojo a few times, but all it does is hype. He's hitting big moves and knocking folks all over the place until he tags in Ryder, and then we slowly but surely kind of transition into the usual thing with Zack Ryder getting beat up a little bit here and there. You know, he's getting whooped on pretty good. We go to commercial break. When we come back, it ends almost immediately. Ryder was in the process, when we came back from commercial, of missing a broski boot, and so he misses that, and it kind of throws him off. Jimmy winds up going up to the top. He nails the big splash off the top, and that's it. 1, 2, 3. The end. It's kind of like, all right. It was abrupt. I mean, Zach didn't even really get the shit kicked out. They didn't even have time, really, to do the whole face in peril thing that they would typically do. And they splashed him and they beat his ass. And then they just rolled him out of the ring like he's nothing, because it's time for the New Day to come out. We don't get any other word about the Hype Bros, though, because the New Day are making their way out. Xavier Woods, Kofi Kingston, Big E, they hit the ring. They're facing off with the Champs before they can leave. Woods says that they are proud of the Usos for actually winning a match without running away. Big E says they want the gold and another title opportunity at Battleground. Well, the Usos are like, you know, we already beat you. They kind of make up a little rhyme, and they wind up accepting the challenge at Battleground. The New Day responds with Kofi. He hits them with a little bit of a rhyme of his own and calls them booty, and they're around, and, you know, the Usos leave, and that's that. So we kind of have a challenge laid out and accepted. It will apparently be the Usos taking on the New Day yet again at Battleground for the tag team titles. So that's going to be interesting. But what I am most interested in here is that the Hype Bros were just immediately fucking forgotten. I don't know what that was all about. They had a nice victory last week over the Colons. It looked like they were going to maybe kind of sort of do something with them. I was still, and kind of am still, of the opinion that maybe we're going to see Mojo turn on Zack Ryder. I don't know about all that. I don't know if maybe they appeared on Talking Smack. They weren't advertised, but maybe they did. I don't know. I guess I'll find out here before too long when the show's over here. But at this given point in time, it's just strange to me that the Hype Bros have gotten a fair amount of hype, if you'll pardon the pun, and then they go out there, they get their opportunity to become number one contenders. They are soundly defeated. Like, they didn't even take, like, a lot of effort. They are just soundly beaten and then discarded. Like, they're nothing. You know, there wasn't anything that happened afterwards. They were just rolled out of the ring so that the New Day could walk out there and look cool. It was like supplemental shit. It wasn't anything. It was like it was never taken seriously in the first place. And, I mean, I knew it wasn't. I knew that the Usos and the New Day wasn't over. We all knew that. But, damn, did they have to be so harsh about it? That's fucking caustic is what that is. It was just, it was mean, almost, to just, hey, hi, bros. Nobody really gives a shit about you. Bye. And that's all she wrote. It was, I don't know what that was all about. Strange, though. Strange. It'll be interesting to see where the Hype Bros go from here after having basically just been, like, full-on dismissed. You know, I mean, hell, at least, like, when the Colons get beat or when the Fashion Police get beat or something like that, at least they, you know, stick around and maybe, you know, they at least get to lay on the mat and look hurt and stuff like that. The Hype Bros just discarded. They were just immediately thrown away to make way for the New Day. It's just, I don't know, there's something about that. I'm not even a big Hype Bros fan. I don't like Mojo. Everybody who listens to this knows that I really don't like Mojo. He's my least favorite guy in the company right now, I think. But damn, you know, that's hard to the core. Wicked and raw. Anyways, after that is all said and done, we see Tamina backstage. She's warm. They let us know that still to come it will be Lana versus Naomi. with the championship on the line. Also, Breezango and the Fashion Files are up next. Looks like they are going to be this week and interrogating the Ascension after it was determined last week that they were the ones who trashed their office and stuff. This week is the interrogation to figure out why. We learn that as we go to commercial. When we come back, we get the promo for Cena's return to SmackDown next week, and then we get Tom Phillips talking a little bit about the Ascension and Breezango, which leads us to the newest edition of the Fashion Files. It's actually Fashion Vice yet again this week, and it's Breeze and Fandango. They are interrogating Connor and Victor. They ask them why. Well, they say that they are going to play good cop, bad cop, you know, and that's pretty interesting. But this was a funny thing. I mean, I don't know exactly how to describe it perfectly, but it was kind of funny. We got Fandango over there, and he's like, "Why'd you trash our stuff?" And the Ascension are like, "No, we didn't actually trash your stuff. We just wanted to get on Money in the Bank." And so it was like, "I believe you, but my partner over here doesn't." And over the course of it, he actually produced a couple of tickets to Eddie Money. He was like, "I got two tickets to paradise right here." And the joke there, most people watching that probably did not get it, frankly. But there's a singer by the name of Eddie Money who sang a song called Two Tickets to Paradise. It's actually a pretty good song. It's not my favorite Eddie Money song, though. I only know a couple of Eddie Money songs, frankly. But my favorite of the two that I do know is Take Me Home Tonight. I don't want to let you go to see the light. Take me home tonight. Listen, neighbor, blue, blee, blah, blah. Be my little baby. It's a great song. Just take my word for it. Fantastic song. I really love it. So I'd take a couple of Eddie Money tickets just to see Take Me Home Tonight perform live. Sure, why not? You know, why not? But the Ascension, of course, turn it down because they only listen to, like, the hardcore thrash or something to that effect. You know, it looked like Victor kind of wanted the tickets, but Connor then reminded him of the fact that they don't do stuff like that. But anyways, it goes back and forth, and Breeze takes a shot at him, but he's not very good at being bad cop. He's over there, and he kind of believes what they have to say as well. But then they go check out what's going on in their office at this time, and it has been destroyed yet again. But the Ascension were still in the interrogation room the whole time, so what's the dealio there? They come back in there, and you see that indeed the Ascension are still sitting there. They're eating some cheese from a cheese platter. And they slowly kind of reach out and take those Eddie Money tickets because, I mean, take me home tonight, I guess, saying to Connor and Victor, you know. Really is a good song, I'm telling you. Anyway, so the mystery continues. Who exactly was it that trashed the Ascension's locker room or I mean, well, their office? I guess we'll find out later at some point. Dun, dun, dun. But it is now time to head out to the ring. First, we do see Natalya backstage warming up, but we head to the ring. Out comes the women's champion, Naomi, and go to commercial. When we come back, out comes Lana. She's actually wearing red this time around. She's not wearing the usual blue dress. I found that kind of interesting. We get formal ring introductions. As Naomi is being introduced and she's holding up the title, Lana attacks from behind. She beats her down and she's stomping on her and kicking on her and stuff. We finally get the referee pulling Lana off of Naomi. Naomi says she's good to go, so the bell rings, and Lana immediately grabs her and hits her with that sit-down finisher thingy of hers that she hits, and only gets a two count out of it. Lana is very upset by this, so Naomi then drops Lana down with a kick. She drags her over to the corner. She nails a split leg and moonsault. She gets the one, the two, and the three. That's it. There were, like, three moves in this entire match. That might be literal, actually. Let's see here. There was that whatever that finisher thing was by Lana. I'm talking after the bell rang because there were some punches and kicks and elbows to the back and stuff like that previously. But after the bell rang, Lana hit her finisher thingy, and then she hollered and yelled, and then she got hit with a kick, and then Naomi dragged her over there and hit the split leg and moonsault. So I think that there were a grand total of three, maybe four moves in this entire match, and Naomi is the winner. That's that. Afterwards, Naomi stands tall. She's raising the title in the air. She's kind of making fun of Lana. She's, like, dusting her boots off in Lana's face. Lana looks very, very sad, and she's, like, she's upset. And Naomi celebrates and goes to leave, and Lana is throwing a fit. And that's all. The end. I was hopeful that we were at least going to get like 5 minutes or something, you know, because like I said at the top of the show, they had a decent match at Money in the Bank. It wasn't great. You know, but it was low level good, you know, it was all right. It was quite good for a first ever singles match, you know, on television, let alone a fucking pay-per-view. So I thought Lana was, you know, damn good. She acquitted herself quite well in that match. But neither of them got the opportunity to show anything in this one. They were just out there and they did things and that was all. And it was lame. I don't know how else to put it. It was fucking weak sauce. I have no clue what this means for Lana. It's hard to tell. Was she even getting a push in the first place, or was this kind of just all meant to humble her? Is she just now going to slot in and just become a random chick in the mix, or is this supposed to make her feel so bad and discourage her so heavily that she goes back to being Rusev's, like, manager lady, or what the hell? I don't know what this is all about, frankly. It's kind of jarring. It was dismissive. I have predicted this to happen. Let's put it that way. And I can't say that I liked it very much. I at least would have liked to have seen a match, you know? But instead, what we got were, like, three moves, and then it was over with. So, the end. We then see Dasha Fuentes backstage talking to Becky Lynch. She's asking her for comments on tonight's main event. Becky says that thankfully Daniel Bryan got rid of James Ellsworth. Now she has a fair chance to be the first ever woman to legitimately win the Money in the Bank. She then pimps away. We go out to the ring and we are introduced to Aiden English. He is in the microphone with a spotlight. He's in the ring, pardon me, with a spotlight and a microphone. He's thinking about, you know, all these things, how great he is. He's hating English, and he's about to get his ass kicked by Randy Orton. Because, indeed, the music hits, and I hear voices in my head. They counsel me. They call me Fred. And then, you know, Randy Orton's coming down there, and that's not good news for Aiden English. I thought they were going to match with each other. Well, we go to commercial break because Randy Orton's coming down there. When we come back, Randy Orton's just chilling in a fucking chair, sitting in the middle of the ring. We get a reap of what happened over the break, and Aiden English ate an RKO from Randy Orton, and that was that. So Orton has a mic sitting there in his chair. He says he's not leaving until he gets what he wants this evening. He says maybe he's not making himself completely clear enough with everything that he's done up to this point. He rips into Jinder Mahal, you know, talking about how what he did last week, replay of it. He says that all that stuff from last week, that pales into comparison to what he's going to do to Jinder if he doesn't get what he wants from him, that being a rematch. What he wants, he's going to go in the back, he's going to beat the hell out of Jinder, then he's going to wait for him in the parking lot and beat the hell out of him out there, then he's going to catch him again as they're leaving at the airport. He didn't flat out say that because I think that's like a federal offense or some shit. He can't just be being like, I'm going to kick your ass in the airport. Like that. Nah, they don't tend to cotton to that too well there, Randall. But anyways, he said, then next week, next Tuesday, wherever we are, basically, he has no clue where the fuck he's going to be a week from tonight, but wherever we're going to be in this great country, he still had to go for the whole great country thing. Wherever we are, he'd kick his ass again there. He's just going to keep on kicking his ass, basically. He's going to kick his ass and kick his ass and kick his ass again as much as he damn well pleases if he does not get what he wants. Well, ain't nobody answering. So he says, well, look, I'm going to the back. And he starts to head out of the ring to go to the back, but then he gets interrupted by the music of Shane McMahon. Shane O'Mac makes his way down there. He says, what's up to San Diego? And then he addresses Orton. He says that he and Orton, they go way back, but they can't have him holding up live TV this evening, and we can't have you threatening the safety of the WWE champion. Orton's like, what? So you coming out here to fire me, or what's the deal here? Because bottom line, I'll buy a ticket to every WWE show that Jinder's at. I'll attack him there. Hell, I'll just keep on doing it. He can sue me. He can have me arrested. He can take every dime that I've got. Because the bottom line is that he laid his hands on and disrespected my family right in front of me. He is going to pay for that. Orton says that Shane can make the wise decision. the easy decision and put him in a match with Jinder, or he can make the tough one and, you know, he's just going to kick his ass anyways. Shane says he gets it. You know, the Singh brothers crossed the line at Money in the Bank, but with all due respect, Orton has used some of those same tactics in the past. You know, but it has to be said, he's never seen this look in Randy Orton's eye, Shane claims, and because he can relate, he knows what it feels like when someone puts their hands on a family member. He says he's got the match. But there is a catch. He does have a match against Jinder Mahal championship, but champion's advantage here, you know, in deference to the champion, Jinder gets to pick what kind of match it is. Bum, bum, bum. Orton doesn't give a shit, he pretty much says. He doesn't care what the stipulation is because the title's coming home where it belongs. But then the badass music hits, and out comes Jinder Mahal alongside the Singh brothers. The modern-day Maharaja is here to drop science. Well, you know, he doesn't exactly drop, so he drops a lot of fucking boring speech. But what it boils down to is that he's going to name his match. He's going to name his match. He mentions how he wants to have specifically a match that was created by and for the great Khali, who is a personal hero of his. You know, like he was a former WWE champion, somebody that Jinder Mahal and the Indian people could look up to. He's going to bring back a match made by Khali, the Punjabi prison. And we get a little video package of the Punjabi prison, which is fucking ridiculous. Inherently ridiculous. They should have waited to do that until after it was all said and done. Go to commercial, come back from commercial, then show it. Because what you've basically just done is you've completely tipped your hand. Are you really going to tell me that the production truck is just constantly sitting around with Punjabi prison footage just on file, just waiting to push the fucking button at any given time in case it's mentioned? No. Nobody had any fucking clue that any of this was going to happen until it happened. Randy Orton literally hijacked the show, and it was thrown out. Oh, Jinder gets to make a stipulation that was created right there in the moment. Jinder comes out, makes the spontaneous stipulation, and the fucking production truck's got a video ready to go. It's like, dude, come on. Come, try a little bit harder. I mean, I know this is fictional, I get it, but damn. Try, man. Give me a tiny amount of effort here. Just a little bit. Fucking fool me. I'm begging you to fool me. Okay? But no. We get a video package that just coincidentally they had queued up in the fucking production truck. And then Jinder's music hits and he stares Orton down. So we're going to have ourselves a Punjabi prison match. The plus side to this is that it's probably going to be the greatest Punjabi prison match of all time. But that's only because the other, I think there were only like two that I can think of off the top of my head, Punjabi prison matches, were just giant steaming piles of shite. They were bad. One of them, it was supposed to be the great Khali versus the Undertaker, and then the day of the show, Khali can't fucking wrestle because he's not healthy enough, because the guy is basically a walking injury waiting to happen, you know, he's just litany of health problems. It's not his fault. I mean, look at the man. He's, you know, a freak of nature. And I mean that in a kind way, you know, kind of like Andre the Giant or El Gigante back in the day, or Giant Gonzalez, as some of you may know him better as. You know, these are legitimate guys who are different. You know, they've got different physiology, and along with that comes some pretty severe health problems from time to time. So, yeah, we're walking into a pay-per-view here. It's the first ever time we've had this fucking Poontang prison match, and we're going to have The Undertaker versus The Great Khali. And, you know, this is coming after the most atrocious thing that has ever happened in WWE history, that being that The Great Khali beat The Undertaker with a fucking karate chop to the head. Allow me to repeat that to you. One time, a few years ago, shortly after Khali came out, was a joke and running around with Natalya and doing the kiss cam and all that bullshit. He was taken deadly seriously. Oh, look at this big giant motherfucker who's all scary looking. Because he does. He looks like something out of a fucking Lord of the Rings movie or something. And he got in the ring with The Undertaker. He karate chopped the dead man upside the head and fucking pinned him. 1, 2, 3. The Undertaker was defeated by a giant man who can barely move, who hit him in the head with a motherfucking karate chop that, I mean, he made Danielson look like fucking Bruce Lee. With that shit. It was the saddest thing you've ever seen in your entire life. I never forgave the great Khali for it. I've still not completely forgiven WWE for it, frankly. But Whew. Yes, they were rolling into that match, going back to my original point. This was a grudge match between Undertaker and Khali. Khali can't even fucking perform, so they trot the Big Show's big happy ass there. Meanwhile, the structure is a clusterfuck. It is very obtrusive, and you can barely see what's going on in the ring. And it's just weird and lame. And then, if I'm not mistaken, there was a second one. I want to say that it was actually Khali in it this time, and I think he faced Batista or something like that. I'm not looking up. But, you know, I don't care enough about it to look it up. But and that one was no better. It's just – it's fucking lame, guys. It's lame. If you really want to – like, it's similar to another piece of wrestle crap history. You remember the Kennel from Hell match? I don't know how many of you remember that. It is notoriously, quite possibly, one of the worst matches in the history of all of professional wrestling. It involved vicious but Rottweilers who were supposed to. The deal was you had a cage and then around the ring, and then Hell in a Cell was around the cage ring structure. You're supposed to climb out of the cage and then make your way out of Hell in a Cell, but outside the ring, between the steel cage and the Hell in a Cell, you've got a bunch of Rottweilers running around. And while they were supposed to be mean and whatnot, they're literally out there, like, licking each other and pooping and, like, trying to mate. And just in general being, you know, I don't know if any of you guys have ever had Rottweilers, but Rottweilers are big goofballs. They're super nice dogs, usually, you know what I mean? It's the same with pit bulls. Pit bulls are typically just big old goofy sweethearts of dogs. And so it was ridiculous. It was terrible. And the Punjabi prison, if memory serves, is similar to that. It's a cage made of bamboo around the ring you have to climb out of, and then you have to make your way out of the Poontang prison itself, which is a somewhat Hell in the Cell-esque structure made of bamboo. So it's just – this one's going to be tough to watch, y'all. This one is going to be tough to watch. Again, at the very least, it looks – best Poontang prison match we've ever seen. So, all right. I guess. Man, Battleground's coming together great. That's really our first match announced for Battleground. Well, our second, I guess, technically, because we did have the tag match announced earlier. I was just talking last week about, like, man, they didn't even mention that Battleground was a thing that's even going to be happening here before too terribly long, about a month away. They didn't even bring it up last week. They were so dealing with the fallout from Money in the Bank. And, well, they mentioned this week, we're going to get ourselves a tag team match, which is fine, but we're also going to get the Punjabi prison match between Randy Orton and Jinder Mahal, and, whoo, good Lord, that's going to be rough, my friend. But we're going to move on from that and we're just going to hope for the best. We see Charlotte backstage. She is warming up, and they let us know that still to come, it will be Sami Zayn taking on Baron Corbin. We come back from the break, and we get the trailer for 2K18 with Seth Rollins and all that stuff. Pretty cool little package there. And when we come back from the break there, we have Mike and Maria Kanellis make their way out onto the stage. This is the first chance we've had to mention them here on the late shift. They showed up at Money in the Bank. Out of the middle of nowhere, and I said my little piece about them there, but they didn't show up last week on SmackDown, which is kind of unusual. I believe they showed up in a dark segment either before or after the here they are. They come out. They don't even really get to talk. So if you didn't see Money in the Bank, I mean, then you just have no clue who the fuck these people are, really, unless you've been watching for a good little while and maybe you still recognize Maria from being around like 7 years ago. Otherwise, you don't really know who these people are, because I have to be completely honest with you. I don't know who the fuck Mike Bennett is. I've heard of the dude. I know that he's Maria's husband, but, I mean, to be frank with you, I don't know really. I've heard good things about what Maria has done since she left WWE. I've heard that she's done good things specifically on the microphone. She's become a great character, a strong character. I'm looking forward to see what she can do. But I remember Maria as the chick who, like, you know, she dated Santino Marella back in the day, and she was kind of dumb. It was not her personally, but her character was kind of dumb, and she did doing it. But apart from that, I don't know anything about Maria. So I'm interested in seeing where these characters go, because I know nothing of Mike, and I know little of Maria's current character, so Yeah, it would have been nice if they would have been able to talk, but they didn't get to talk. Because Maria begins to say stuff, but then Sami Zayn's music interrupts. He comes out there. He kind of apologizes for crashing their segment, but he's like, you know, I've got a match here. So he heads on down to the ring. And there you go. He heads down to the ring. Everybody's awfully happy about it. And then out comes Mr. Money in the Bank, Baron Corbin. He's got his briefcase and everything. At this point, the Kanellises are gone. And just a little aside here before we dive into this match, I'm guessing that it is going to be Mike and Maria taking on Sami Zayn. I'm guessing that's going to be the first feud for Mike and Maria Kanellis. I think it will be against Sami Zayn for interrupting them. They're probably going to take umbrage to it next week. Maybe they'll interrupt him, or maybe they'll talk to him backstage, or they'll talk some shit, or maybe Mike will attack him from behind while he's in match, or who the hell knows. But I think that that was, you know, very rarely does something happen in pro wrestling that just means nothing. And I think that this was intended as kind of like, oh, shit, I was about to start talking here. I'm the first lady of SmackDown, the first lady of pro wrestling. You're going to come out here and fucking interrupt me? My husband's about to teach you some manners. I'm thinking that's what Maria's thinking right now. Not me. I don't have a husband. And I don't care if Sami Zayn were to interrupt me because he could probably kick my ass, frankly. But, again, I digress. That's just a little guess, my little prediction. I'm thinking that the first feud for the Kanellises is going to be with Sami Zayn. But for right now, Sami Zayn's got other shit to take care of here. He has had a long-running feud with Baron Corbin. As I mentioned early on when we were talking about this at the top of the show, they've had like two matches. This is their third real match, you know, one-on-one, if I'm not mistaken. And Sami has gotten the victory over him a couple of times here. So this is kind of a monkey that Baron wants to get off of his back so that he can move on. He stepped it up. He is now Mr. Money Bank. Can't be just coming out there and losing to little dudes like old Sami Zayn here, man. He's, you know, he's a fucking wet fart away from being in the cruiserweight division. You don't want to be losing to that guy, Baron. No. So this is something, some course correction time here for Baron Corbin. But at the meantime, Sami Zayn, you know, this is a good opportunity for him. He's already beaten this dude a couple of times. He thinks he's got his number. He very well may be right. And now this dude is Mr. Money in the Bank. So, you know, you stack up some victories against this dude. Say he cashes in. Well, you're looking pretty good for a fucking title shot is what you're looking. So the bell rings. They immediately lock up. Corbin drops Sami down and puts him up against the ropes. Sami counters out of it and winds up tossing Corbin out with leg scissors. He tries to maintain control, being Corbin. He tries to bring back control, but he misses a big clothesline in the corner. Sami turns it around and mounts Corbin with some big right hands in the corner. Corbin rolls out for a breather. Sami runs the ropes looking like he's going to dive out there, but Baron is able to get up, so he puts on the brakes. He waits till he gets around to the other side, though, and then Sami launches himself over the top rope. Baron catches him and drops him face first on top of the barrier as we go to commercial break. When we return, Baron Corbin is in the process of covering for a two count after nailing a ginormous clothesline on old Sami Zayn. He continues beating his ass and kicking his ass all over the place. Sammy's trying to make a little bit of a comeback here. He winds up running Corbin into a ring post. Sami goes up top to nail a cross body on him. He does so, but is able to kick out at two, though. He went for a big suplex, he being Sami, but it is blocked. We see Shinsuke Nakamura watching backstage, by the way. Corbin winds up nailing a big right hand, which dazes Sami into the corner. Corbin decks Sami one more again, follows it up with a great big clothesline still in the corner. He charges in yet again, but Sami's able to move out of the way. He gets a roll-up for a very close two count. Corbin takes it back into the corner, trying to maintain control here. He takes Sami up top, but Sami is able to fight his way out of it. He headbutts Corbin down to the mat, stands up, and he goes to jump off, but Corbin is able to get closer to him, so Sami has to stop and kind of land on his feet, roll through. He turns around, Baron catches Sami just fluidly into the end of days, and we get the one, the two, and the three. It seems like it had been so long since I saw a good end of days. I know we saw a couple of weeks ago with Nakamura, but it wasn't like, you know, he didn't really stick him. It's different for him to just, like, hit at somebody. But I really, really like it when it is incorporated in a match, like somebody runs into it or this or that. They did a good one this evening. It's been a little while, it feels like, since we've kind of seen something of that ilk. So Baron Corbin gets the victory here. He's finally shaken the monkey off of his back. He's taken out Sami Zayn. What this means for Sami, I'm not entirely sure, though I am, again, guessing that he has got Mike and Maria there in his not-too-distant future, just based on what we saw before this whole thing started. Pardon me. As for Baron Corbin, I'm thinking he got the victory here. It feels like this feels like it was the period at the end of the sentence. It feels to me like, yeah, Sammy got a couple of victories over him. That'll be file that away because I'm sure it'll be brought up again at some point in the future, you know, when Baron Corbin's the champion and he's facing off against Sami Zayn or vice versa. We're going to have talk about how, you know, Baron Corbin, he doesn't have the best win-loss record against Sami Zayn. Sami Zayn has gotten the best of him multiple times, blah, blah, blah. And if you think that's bullshit, well, look at The Undertaker and Shawn Michaels going into their WrestleMania match, the first of the two in a row there, arguably the greatest match of all time. They were bringing it up rather frequently, the fact that The Undertaker at that point, it was WrestleMania 25, The Undertaker at that point had never beaten Shawn Michaels. Shawn had his number. So, I don't know. Maybe just file it away in the back of your head and remember that Sammy and Baron have a bit of a history here and that it has gone more towards Sammy than it has towards Baron. But tonight, it did go into Baron Corbin's favor. He got the victory, and it looks like they are going their separate ways. Again, I do believe that Sami Zayn is going to be dealing with Maria and Mike. As to Baron, as soon as the match was over with, we went backstage. Sasha was there with Shinsuke Nakamura, who, as mentioned, was watching on a backstage monitor. She's like, what do you think about a potential match between you and Baron Corbin? Nakamura says that Corbin is dangerous, but that Corbin is motivated by fear. Fear of what Nakamura can do. And perhaps Corbin is right to be afraid. Nakamura twitches away, and that's that. And the fans are chanting his name and stuff. So, Nakamura and Baron Corbin looks like a thing that is going to be happening in the not-too-distant future. And as is the case with a lot of Money in the Bank guys, I've noticed over the years, they tend to go one of two ways. Either they push the sweet bejesus out of them immediately, or they let it breathe. They let it breathe. They let him have a feud. He's probably going to lose this feud to Nakamura, I'm telling you right now. I don't see Nakamura losing a match for a while, all right? I think that Nakamura could very well end this calendar year without having lost a match. Depends on who he winds up facing over the course of these next few months, but I could definitely see that being a scenario. I think that Baron Corbin is going to lose, ultimately, in the feud with Shinsuke Nakamura. But that he still got that briefcase. So at the end of the day, Baron Corbin's one match, and it doesn't even really have to be a full-on match. It could be just one ding, 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 pinfall, ding, 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 you know, away from being a big-timer. So I think that's how they're going to use the briefcase as it pertains to Corbin. It's kind of what they did with Edge. You know, Edge didn't become just Mr. Badass McGee as soon as he won Money in the Bank. He was still Edge. He was losing here and there. He was, you know, doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And then he cast in and kind of became a big shot. So I'm interested in seeing how this plays out. That's a couple of feuds that I'm intrigued in. I'm intrigued in Zayn versus Mike and Maria because I'm just interested in seeing what Mike and Maria's characters are going to be. And I don't know if this Mike Bennett guy can fucking wrestle. I'll be the judge of that. You don't have to tell me whether or not he can because I'm sure that the guy's decent enough or they wouldn't have signed him in the first place. He would have worked everywhere that he has worked. That having been said, I will be the judge of whether or not I dig what he does in the ring. You know, I mean, maybe I'll like it, maybe I won't. At the end of the day, this looks like it's going to be a very character-driven gimmick, and I kind of already think that I'm going to like Maria. I haven't seen a lot from her, but I think I'm going to like what she's bringing to the table. Either way, I'm looking forward to that just because of the intrigue of getting to see somebody new and what they have to bring to the table, and Zayn is fully capable of making anybody look like a million damn dollars. As to Baron Corbin and Shinsuke Nakamura, that sounds like a pretty fucking good feud to me. That's going to be hard-hitting, I'm just looking forward to that one. I like both of those dudes, so I'm ready to see what they can do with each other. But after that's all said and done, and we've talked to Nakamura and all that good stuff, it is just about time, the Women's Money in the Bank ladder match, the rematch for this whole thing. We go to commercial. When we return, we get news that next week on SmackDown, it will be the Usos versus The New Day in a wrap-off. Yeah. A wrap-off. That's a thing. That's happening. And somewhere over the midst of this, I missed it. It's not here in the notes and stuff that I noticed. Daniel Bryan is backstage, and he was talking about the Punjabi prison. I guess it was right after the Punjabi prison announcement. I guess I just missed this. Sorry, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit here to before Zayn versus Corbin. AJ Styles walked in, and he was talking about Kevin Owens' open challenge. And this is brought to mind because they're making matches for next week and stuff. You know, Kevin Owens is right behind him, and he's like, oh, you're talking about me behind my back? How very American of you, basically. Owens is like, blah, 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 you know, I wanted to give the opportunity to people who I've never beaten for the U.S. title before. That doesn't count for you, AJ, because I've beaten you and you're a loser. AJ says that if Owens accepts the fact that Owens is Ron Burgundy's definition of San Diego, then blah, 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 blah. And it's like, I don't quite get that joke. Maybe it's been too long since I saw Anchorman, I suppose. Didn't he say, like, fuck off San Diego or something to that effect? I don't know. Either way, Owens gets upset. He doesn't understand the reference, much like myself. Brian announces, hey, you know, we're talking about open challenges and all that stuff. Next week is the 4th of July. You're the U.S. champion. How's this right here? We're going to have an Independence Day Battle Royal for next week's SmackDown. The winner of the said Battle Royal will face Kevin Owens at Battleground for the championship. Owens hates this idea. AJ just wants to know if he's in it. Daniel Bryan lets him know that he is, and we are on our way. So that's what we've got set up for next week. We have got, of course, we've got the return of John Cena. We've known that for weeks now. We're going to see the return of John Cena. We're going to see an Independence Day Battle Royal to determine the number one contender for the U.S. title. And we're going to see a wrap-off between the Usos and the New Day. Right on. But now it's time for the Women's Money in the Bank ladder match. The first ever second Women's Money in the Bank ladder match. This is the second one. As I mentioned last week, it's kind of too little too late. You know, they're trying to backtrack, trying to fix things, and it's not that it don't work like that, y'all. It don't work like that, but they're trying. We have Charlotte, Carmella, Natalya, Tamina, and Becky Lynch. They all come out. Everybody's all standing in the ring, and everybody immediately goes at it. Tamina works over Charlotte in the corner, and Natalya attacks Becky. Everybody winds up outside the ring, which leaves Carmella all by her lonesome, just standing there in the ring. So she's like, fuck all that noise. There's a ladder, sets it up. She's looking to go ahead and just climb up there and grab the briefcase. Hell, if everybody else wants to be all distracted and fight each other and just leave her alone to her own devices, well, hey, man, go ahead, go right ahead. Climb on up there. Take advantage of this stuff. You know what I mean? So she's going for it. She is going for it. Man, everybody comes in there, pulls her down, and it turns it into a great big old fight all over the place. This was a better match than the match than the first Women's Money in the Bank ladder match. That one just didn't quite have the psychology behind it. It felt like I felt like it needed some big bumps, but that's not even necessarily true. I mean, you're conditioned to see big bumps in a ladder match, but that doesn't have to happen. As long as you've got the psychology and bumps here and there that look kind of painful just to back it up. You do want to use the ladder from time to time, you know what I mean? But tonight they didn't, but it was still a match than what we saw at the pay-per-view, even though there were a few ladder bumps at the pay-per-view. Tonight, not so much. There were people pushed off of the ladder and stuff like that. There was, you know, ladders put over people and people's faces smacked into ladders. But there weren't, like, body slams on ladders. There were no, like, moonsaults through ladders or none of that stuff. So it was a little lighter as compared to your usual ladder match fare. But it did have some pretty strong psychology, and the main component in that being that everybody fucking hates Carmella. Nobody wants Carmella to win this thing. Meanwhile, Carmella is looking for any sneaky, underhanded opportunity to win this thing when she can get the opportunity to do so. Everybody else trying to stop her. Active, they don't, you know, they all want to individually win, but the only other thing they all agree on is that they don't want to win because fuck Carmella. So everybody's fighting all over the place, outside the ring, inside the ring, dumping each other off of ladders, all of this. At one point, Charlotte and Tamina are fighting for the ladder, and they're just standing there holding it, kind of playing tug-of-war a little bit. It was awkward because they weren't even pulling back and forth. They were just standing there holding the ladder, and it looked like they were waiting, frankly. And we found out what they were waiting for because Becky runs in there and proceeds to start climbing up the ladder, and Tamina and Charlotte are just holding it. They're not shaking it. They're not looking like, what are you doing? They're not doing anything. They just stood there and held it while Becky kind of slowly made her way up the ladder, standing there. It's like they were helping her. It's like they were in such shock that they were just like, oh, we got to hold this ladder for her. She needs to change the light bulb. You know, I mean, it was a bad spot. I've seen similar spots to that in the past. I believe that back in the day, it was either Shelton Benjamin or Kofi Kingston who did a similar spot. I can't remember which, like, super athletic jumping onto ladders guy that it was. I believe it was one of those two, though. Might have been John Morrison. I'm not entirely sure. It was somebody of that ilk, either way. So they've done similar spots in the past. But it didn't work this evening because everybody just looked so awkward at it. It literally looked like they were just helping Becky. And that's not what it's supposed to look like. But eventually they do, you know, kind of knock it over and Becky gets hit and everybody's fighting all over the place. This was better, you know, save that one really bad, shitty spot there. This was indeed better than what we saw at the pay-per-view. We get down towards the end of things here and we've got Natalya nails just a vicious sit-out powerbomb to Becky. It was a great sit-out powerbomb. She then straps the sharpshooter onto Carmella. Charlotte comes in there to break it up with a big boot to take out Natalya. She then nails Natural Selection on Natalya as well. Charlotte and Natalya tumble out to the floor at this point. They're fighting each other all over the place. Natalya knocks Charlotte over the barrier, trying to keep her away, and winds up following her. I initially thought she was trying to keep her away from the ring, but then she followed her and just decided she was going to punch her in the head. So they're fighting out in the crowd, way away from the ring. It looks like nothing's going on here. There's nobody in the ring. It's just wide open for something crazy to happen. And, well, here comes James Ellsworth. The Big Hog has building in some way and has snuck through the crowd. He jumps over the barrier, checks on Carmella at ringside. The referees are running over there to yell at him, but there are no rules, as has been previously established. He winds up rolling Carmella into the ring. He stands the ladder up and goes climbing up it so that he can get the briefcase. Just basically a complete and total replay of what we saw on Money in the Bank. But it's a bit of a reversal here. Becky runs in. She kicks Carmella in the face, and she winds up tipping the ladder over. Ellsworth crotches himself on the top rope as he falls off of it. Becky, it looks like she's got clear sailing. She positions the ladder, goes to climb up it, but Carmella tries to pull her down. Becky kicks her away, but then here comes back Carmella. She's not giving up quite that easily. She pulls her down. When she falls, she winds up tweaking her leg a little bit. Carmella winds up kicked out of the ring, and Becky goes to climb up again, but she's a little hindered by the fact that her knee is messed up. This leads to Carmella coming in there with a steel chair. She nails her in the back of the knee with the edge of the steel chair. That brings her, of course, down off of the ladder, and she's holding her knee, which means that Carmella is going to smack her in the back with said steel chair. That's that. She's out of the ring. Everybody else is occupied. Apparently Tamina's dead or something. I don't know where the hell she is in the midst of all of this, but I do know that we've got Natalya and Charlotte fighting out in the crowd, so they're not even close enough to try to help anything here. And meanwhile, Carmella just traipses her ass up there, unhooks the briefcase, and is the new old, the once and future Miss Money in the Bank, Carmella. She stands upon the ladder, sits up on top of that, holding the briefcase up, explaining. Tamina looks disgusted. And almost like she's been crying. Same goes for Charlotte. She almost looks like she's damn near in tears or exhausted or something. She's just selling really well. She looks disgusted by this. Everybody looks upset. But this time, pretty much fair and square, Carmella got the victory. Because, you know, Ellsworth didn't really do anything. He set up the ladder. But he didn't hit nobody or none of that. He tried to interfere, but it didn't work out for him. He wound up getting his just desserts and, you know, a little bit of a payback there. Again, that was WWE being like, we're sorry that we were so fucking tone deaf and did something stupid at Money in the Bank. So here's our make good. Here's the evil man guy getting his balls hit and stuff. And yay, Becky. But at the end of the day, it's still Carmella, which just compounds it to me. It makes me believe even further that this was not the plan. This was not the plan for this match. This rematch of the Women's Money in the Bank was purely a reactionary thing from WWE upon seeing how the audience reacted to the Women's Money in the Bank ladder match. I think that they were just going to ride with it. She was just going to be Miss Money in the Bank, and that's the way that it was going to be. And, of course, people aren't going to like it. You're not supposed to. She's a heel. But people didn't like it because they felt like it was a slap in the face and that it was sexist and all this. WWE, I was wondering last week, did they backtrack? You know, were they just appeasing the fans, or was this the plan all along? We got the answer this week because Carmella is still Miss Money in the Bank. I think that makes it pretty fucking odd. But we will talk about this episode of SmackDown in its entirety. We will grade this whole thing. Was it good? Was it bad? Some of the stuff we know was bad. Some though was a good, decent, at least, Money in the Bank, able to put this over the top. We'll discuss that in just a moment as I give this show a grade. But first, I invite you to check out this right here. All right, back in the mix here, and I don't even know if, like, the schedule and stuff just played. For some reason, I'm not hearing things in my headset. I'm assuming the show's on the air because I've had some interactions on Twitter, and I see that some people are live listening here in the studio, so I'm assuming that everything is hunky-dory as it pertains to my audio, but I'm certainly not hearing the show audio, the, you know, the little stingers and the intros and the schedule and all that good stuff. You know, if I was just quiet for a really long time for no reason, I apologize. I didn't know if the schedule was playing or not, and I didn't want to just interrupt it. But speaking of the schedule, it is worth noting that you are definitely going to want to tune back a little bit, go back a few days, and check out this last Sunday. We had the first edition of The Right Side of the Dock Says. It's not the first ever edition. Of course, they did a special series back in March. Looking at the career of The Undertaker. They're back again. It's, of course, the Doc from The Doc Says and the guys from the Right Side of the Pond. They are taking a look at the career of Triple H this time around. They're going to be doing about 3 episodes of that over the course of the next few weeks. And the first one was just this last weekend, so go back and check that out. And pardon me. Of course, just a bit of a programming note here. Next week, on the Monday edition of The Late Shift, we will, of course, be at – it's already the go-home show for Great Balls of Fire. So I'm looking forward to giving my predictions for that show. I don't know what to think about some of these matches. I'm very interested to see whether or not after next week's Raw, if maybe my opinion has shifted or come a little bit more clearly to light. I guess we'll find out once we get there, but that's going to be a fun show when we get to it next Monday on The Late Shift. But for now, the Tuesday edition of the program, it is time to give this episode of SmackDown a grade, and I wanted to like it. This one had potential. It really had potential. I thought this was going to be pretty damn cool because, man, I thought this was going to be a strong women's night. I thought this was going to be a fantastic week for women's wrestling in regards to, you know, the 30-plus minute match that we had last night on Monday Night Raw. That was actually quite good. Nia Jax looked like $1 million. Sasha looked really good. I thought it was a strong match. Not for everybody involved, but I thought that it was overall the story that they told and just the match as a piece itself was quality. pardon me. And then I thought that tonight we were going to get ourselves not only a Women's Money in the Bank ladder match that hopefully exceeded the somewhat tepid one from the actual Money in the Bank pay-per-view, but I figured we were also going to get at least a comparable match out of Lana and Naomi, and we didn't. We did not get a comparable match to the Money in the Bank match because the Money in the Bank match was actually all right. I didn't dislike that match at all. Tonight was 3 moves and a squash. That was it. It's kind of, I don't know if it was designed to make Naomi look super good or if it was designed to make Lana look super bad, or I don't know what the motivation was there, but that sucked dick is what that did. That was really lame. But as to the rest of the show, it was just kind of down the middle, honestly. The opening segment was all right, but it was repeating shit that we had heard last week. It was entertaining watching Daniel Bryan throw the big hog out, but at the same time, I mean, it really was just retreading a lot of the same things that we saw last week. The Hype Bros versus the Usos was decent enough while it lasted. It was okay. It seemed like the majority of it happened during the fucking commercial break in that little corner screen while we watched various things, you know, trying to sell us Toyotas and whatnot. And it just ended so abruptly out of the middle of nowhere. And then the Hype Bros were tossed aside like fucking garbage so that the New Day could come out there and engage in a pseudo rap battle to set up an actual rap battle next week. It was like kind of embarrassing. Again, I'm not a big fan of the Hype Bros necessarily. I especially do not like Mojo. Damn, that's kind of fucking harsh, guys. That was not a cool thing to do, honestly, in my opinion. But so that match was it was only partially decent in the first place, but then the end of it was just ass. So I got to give that one was a bad match. I just have to say, I mean, all things told, that was not a good match. We had the Fashion Vice thing, fucking gold. I loved it. The Eddie Money jokes, and that was maybe the best part of the entire show, to be completely honest with you. The Women's Championship match was a massive letdown in every way, shape, form, just every way, in every single way. They even changed Lana's outfit because Lana was wearing an outfit at Money in the Bank that, you know, I've said a million times that looks don't matter, that talent matters, and all that good stuff, and that's absolutely true. I hold steadfastly to that, but at the same time, I happen to be a heterosexual male. You know, you may not be listening to this, and you know what? More power to you. I love any and everybody. I don't care your gender identification. I don't care what you are, who you love. That you're cool with me. But I personally am a heterosexual male, and Lana looked motherfucking num-nums at Money in the Bank. And she had a different outfit on even this time. So, I mean, that's just an example of the fact that they even took away the delicious outfit that she was wearing. And then they fucking squash her. It was just this women's match pissed me off, frankly. This sucked. It felt like a slap in the face, kind of. I was not happy with this women's championship match. Maybe I'll change my mind on it once the motivation behind it becomes a little bit more clear. Maybe things will... You know, maybe things will come to light as we move forward and we'll see justification for why they did this. But as of this moment, I really fucking hated it. Really, really hated it. The Randy Orton segment in the ring was lame. I mean, Randy is not exactly Mr. Personality. Shane did what he could, but he wasn't exactly, you know, sparkling wit out there either. It was boring between them two. And then Jinder comes out and he bees fucking RoboCop and it wasn't very good. And then we top it all off with the introduction of the fact that, oh yeah, we're bringing back what is one of the most notoriously bad matches in the history of WWE because racial stereotype, you know, it's got Punjabi in it. So we have to bring it back. It's fucking ridiculous. So that segment was really not that good. And it all topped off with a match that is probably just going to be really fucking difficult to sit and watch. Sammy versus Baron was pretty good. I enjoyed that. It wasn't the greatest thing in the world. It wasn't even as good as their other matches, but it was pretty good. I liked it. I like how Baron was just like, maybe the issue is that I've been letting this little fucker hang around for too long. So when he saw an opening to nail the End of Days, he did it. And that was that. And I have to say that the Women's Money in the Bank ladder match was superior to the one that they had at the pay-per-view. It had its issues. Tamina and Charlotte basically standing there holding the ladder and allowing Becky to climb up there and take a shot at getting the briefcase. That was a bit wonky. There were, you know, it had its issues here and there, but that's inexperience. None of these women have ever really been in a ladder match aside from the one at Money in the Bank, and that one wasn't that very good, so is what it is. But overall, this episode of SmackDown was a massive letdown. Just a massive, massive letdown. It only had one pseudo-okay match that I don't have any complaints about whatsoever. Even the segments were really not that good. All that was good was the Fashion Police. And I would say that the Women's Money in the Bank was all right. Baron Corbin and Sami Zayn was all right as well. This gets a D+. A D+. For SmackDown this evening. And I was really looking at potentially this being a fucking A show. I really thought that this had been. That maybe next week when John Cena comes back and we have a battle rap and all kinds of stuff with that. So who knows? Maybe we will see. I will be here with you next week, though. Hopefully you will join me on the 4th of July. But for now, well, I'm going to head on out of here. I will also be back with you next Monday. And we're going to be having some fun as we see the Go Home show for Great Balls of Fire. I'll be here with you then. Hope that you will join me. Same goes for next Tuesday. I'll be here with you then. It's going to be good times, my friends. So until then, until we get together to do it again, you guys, please take care of yourselves out there in the really real world, and remember that nothing is trivial, all right? All right, much love, guys. We'll catch you next time. Bye, everybody. Bye. Bye.